November 17th, 1981. Back in the days before June 21st, 1956, when Sharifa and I were living in our self-built house in the town of San Fernando, surrounded by the city of Los Angeles, we had contacts with some very interesting people, which we no longer had after moving to Santa Barbara. Among these, there was one known as Dr. Waltman, a psychological therapist, not a psychiatrist, but one who employed analysis and not medication in the dealing with psychological problems. In a broad sense, psychological therapy is a process of rendering an individual capable of adjustment with his life and the environment in which he lives, so that he can conduct himself normally and more or less happily in reasonable adjustment. Now, we had had several discussions with Dr. Waltman, in which there were evident certain differences of point of view. A certain statement of his was a conclusion that brought to focus the points of our difference. This was as follows. We should not conclude, although it is necessary to decide. A very simple statement, but it carries profound implications. First of all, what is the meaning of conclusion and of decision? Conclusion is that at which we arrive when we resolve a mathematical problem, or when we have resolved problems in general. But preeminently, it is represented by the QED with which the proofs of Greek geometry are concluded. Conclusion is thus a process of arriving at a thought-out determination. Deciding, on the other hand, may not be grounded in any considerable degree of certainty. It may be, in fact, arise in the dealing with a situation where the elements before one, with respect to which the individual must make some relation, and even though there is nothing like certainty as to consequence. Deciding involves an act of determination, more in terms of action, or rather most typically in terms of action, rather than involving a conclusion as to true or false. One may decide to venture in a very questionable zone as a sort of voyage of discovery, or one may decide to acquire an object, even though there is no positive proof that that is the object he most would value. One may decide on the basis of simple inclination, a passing impulse, and a simple impression, where there is no question of a proof that leads to a conclusion. I've studied this distinction over the years since then, and find myself determinedly in disagreement with the position advanced by Dr. Volkmann. In any matter of importance, my tendency is to consider all possible alternatives, or at least the alternatives that are most obvious and immediately available. And then among those alternatives, after having thought them over, concluded that thus and so is the alternative best to choose, and then on the basis of that conclusion, making a decision of the appropriate action. It is my normal process of functioning. But the formula advanced by Dr. Volkmann interdicts that process. Why? This is a question I've held in my mind for years. And I think there may be some correlation with this situation as compared to the double evolution in the human being that has been outlined in our preceding discussion. The double evolution consists of the following: the evolution of the ape-like creature, the human being as he was before the superimposition of the Manasaputra. The second evolution is that of the intellectual mind, the conceptual mind, which was derived through the superimposition of the Manasaputra. Now, let us take the ape-like creature as he was before he came into the possession of a conceptual mind. What would be his determinants in action? So far as I can see, they'd be essentially the determinants that apply to members of the animal kingdom. Members of the animal kingdom have a certain zone of freedom. They obviously make decisions whether they will go this way or that way, whether they will partake of this herbage or that herbage, and so forth. Something decides in them. The decision that leads to action. But we have no reason to believe that they go through any complicated thought process in which they weigh the pros and cons with respect to different alternatives in possible action. They function otherwise. There is impulse, there may be instinct, there may be something akin to an intuition. But it seems to be a non-judging process. Although, to make a final decision in this respect, one would have to go through the experience of superimposition of his own consciousness upon that of an animal so that he can study how the animal actually functions. Very largely, we study the animal through watching his behavior and inferring what may be the process as a result of watching that behavior. This, in fact, has led to what is known as behaviorism, a form of psychological interpretation. Another way would be to suspend as far as possible our conceptual processes and watch those processes that remain, which are of the nature of instinct, of impulse, possibly something of intuition, a moving by inclination without the exercise of judgment. There's much here that is not absolutely certain, but I find the best way to get at this material is to suspend for the time being, one's intellectual capacities and study the action of what is left as far as that is possible. For we too, in part of our nature, are animals.
While it is true that I reject Volkmann's dictum as a philosophical principle of universal validity, it nonetheless remains possible that in dealing with the psychological therapeutic problems of individuals, there may be a need in the specific individual for such a suspension of the principle of inclusion. This is not the question in which I am primarily interested, as I am interested in the larger philosophical question. But I do grant that supplies a zone of possible validity. Take, for instance, the type of individual which I earlier symbolized by the creatures which abide under rocks that may be lying on the surface of the ground. Insects, spiders, scorpions, centipedes, I have found there. And as soon as the light hits them, they scurry in order to achieve shade. Now, for some human beings, the Luciferian light may indeed be too bright, and therefore produces a psychological disturbance, a maladjustment in the psychic system. And in this case, the formula provided by Dr. Volkmann may indeed be valid. I'm not challenging that as a heuristic principle. I am challenging its universal application as a philosophical principle.
In the tapes devoted to the discussions between Dr. Brewjoy and myself, there is often found a heavy disparagement of the principle of judgment by Dr. Brewjoy. This brings up a problem which I find very similar to that which I discussed in connection with Dr. Volkmann. It may be that Dr. Joy uses the word judgment in a more restricted sense than I find given in the Dictionary on Philosophy and Psychology. But if it is to be understood in the broad sense, judgment is an essential of conceptual thought. There is no conceptual thinking without judgmental determination. That is a very fundamental principle. Now, if we assume that the position taken by Dr. Joy with respect to judgment is to be understood in the broad use of the term as given in philosophy, then we achieve essentially the same consequence that applies in the case of the thesis of Dr. Volkmann. Without judgment, which means determination in the sense of clear definition, there can be no conceptual thinking, or at least no effective, responsible conceptual thinking. If that is the meaning intended by Dr. Joy, then he too is disparaging and seeking to exclude the conceptual mind as a fundamental element in thought. In fact, it very largely eliminates directed thought as such. Now, I do find in literature a position analogous to this. It is to be found in Zen Buddhism, which was a production of the Japanese mind. Insofar as I am familiar with statements from the Zen Buddhism, it disparages all conceptual thinking and operates by processes which seem to be indigenous to man, who in the stage that was pre-conceptual. And that again would be the ape-like creature. The creature who moved on the basis of instinct, sense impression, impulse, intuition, but without use of judgmental process. I myself feel that this is a reversion to a more primitive condition. It is not the position which I recommend in the field of yoga or in the field of practical action, or in the field of general systematic thought. I agree with the position affirmed again and again in the Secret Doctrine that the descending Manasaputra are relatively gods as compared to the ape-like creature on which they produced a superimposition, and that therefore it is our highest developed function. No doubt that above the mind there lies the spiritual side of man, which transcends the conceptual, as well as the ape-like creature. It may be that influence can flow directly from the divine portion of man to the more animalistic portion of man without passing through the conceptual power. That may be, but it appears to me that it is not the royal way, certainly not the way of Shankara. I recommend the path in which the most thoroughly developed mental power is employed. And I view the intermediate principle, or the intellectual mind as the mediator between that which is above and therefore spiritual, and that which is below and therefore animal. Man is a triune being, a God, a man, and in the outer base, an animal. As a footnote, I am inclined to make a personal confession which is pertinent to with respect to the double evolution represented by the ape-like creature and the superimposed Manasaputra. In my early life, when I came to the period of adolescence, I found that two interests broke out. One was the ordinary biological interest, which every young man faces, and the other was an interest in self-determined thought. In the competition between these two factors, the tendency towards self-directed thought had a repressive effect upon biological interest and has become the strongest driving force throughout the life as a whole. Now there is a clear tie-in between these two. Clearly, the ape-like creature brings to us that which is the basis of this living organism. On the other hand, the superimposed capacity of the Manasaputra, or the capacity of conceptual thought, is related to the descent of the Dhyanchwanic element. Now, in most of human life, so far as my observation goes, thought is subordinate to the life interest. It is directed preeminently, apparently by the overwhelming mass of human beings, to the process of supporting life, the production of necessary food, of various objects of interest or necessity in life, the maintenance of the organism against enemies, either on the human level itself or on the level of disease or otherwise, and the maintenance of the species or of the nation. Whereas the counter interest would be that of a primary interest in the adventure of thought itself with the life factor, that which supports the individual as a living organism, playing a subordinate instrumental role. Now, in my case, the thought took primacy over biological interest or life interest. So I would say we have two primary functions or faculties are modes that govern in our existence, namely that of light and that of thought. The giving a primacy to the adventure of thought leads to an inversion of the pragmatic orientation which I discussed in the body of the text, where it was maintained that the thinking was solely for the purpose of leading to experiences in the sensible sense which could be expected, or the laying down of principles of conduct which would be recommended, a reformulation of the statement of William James. In this other orientation of which I've spoken, we have the reverse position. Life is viewed as instrumental to thought, and the aim of thought is the determination of truth. We need an organism here if we are to think in this world, and in that case the organism is supported as instrumental to the thinking, and not the other way around, at least not primarily the other way around. To be sure, a certain proportion of thought must be employed in the gaining of a livelihood and the maintenance of health and in biological activity if the individual and the species is to survive. But that may be viewed as subordinate, as instrumental essentially, whereas the primary goal, the primary objective, is the attainment of truth for its own sake. This latter, I must admit, has been throughout my life my primary orientation. Truth for its own sake, not as instrumental to life, but as an end in itself. Whereas that which belonged to life was viewed as instrumental, the organism must be maintained if it is to think in this world, but is not viewed as an end in itself. This is a point of view to which I make confession. Apparently, few take this position, and most view thought as instrumental to life.